From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. After 2.5 years of furious debate following the publication of a New York Times story about the government's secret warrantless wiretapping program, on Thursday, the president signed the new Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Today, I'm pleased to sign landmark legislation that is vital to the security of our people. The bill will allow our intelligence professionals to quickly and effectively monitor the communications of terrorists abroad while respecting the liberties of Americans here at home.
The new law still requires the government to obtain warrants to eavesdrop on U.S. citizens, but permits it to listen in on the phone calls of foreign nationals outside the country without warrants, even if they are speaking to people in the U.S. It grants retroactive immunity to the telecom companies that assisted in the earlier eavesdropping and effectively closes down dozens of lawsuits challenging the program's legality. It also expands the government's power to invoke emergency wiretapping procedures. Despite the vehement protests of liberal Democrats and civil liberties advocates, it easily passed both in the House, 293 to 129, and the Senate, 69 to 28. Tim Starks has been following the bill for Congressional Quarterly. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, let me see if I understand this correctly. If I am suspected of, let's say, participation in organized crime, the federal government or the local police can get a wiretap on me, but they have to go to a court. Under the 1978 version of FISA, the federal government had the option of going to a secret court in order to get a court order for a wiretap. But as the New York Times revealed, in the last few years, the administration has been skipping the court process altogether and simply getting the wiretaps under a presidential finding that does not involve the judiciary at all. Does the new version of FISA etch that ability into concrete?
That is essentially what it does. Now, keep in mind that there is something unique about the way this law is structured, in that it is most focused on who the government is targeting. So if you're in the United States and they decide that they would like to go after you and monitor your communications as the target of interest, then they do still need a warrant. But if the government declares that someone overseas is its target, whether that person is communicating with someone in the United States or not, the government does not need a warrant. The courts are effectively out of that deal. The people in the administration are the people who end up deciding who they can conduct surveillance of in those circumstances with no oversight from the court.
Now, there were two issues here, as I understand it. One was whether, in the name of national security, the president should have such wide berth to do the kind of snooping that had long since been illegal in this country. And the second, whether the phone companies who cooperated with these warrantless searches were liable in court for either prosecution or litigation based on helping the administration violate individual privacy. To protect them, this law actually gives them immunity from any kind of suit. Why was this an issue?
There were a few reasons. One is that they argued that if the government came to them with another request to help conduct spying, those phone companies would be more concerned about their exposure to lawsuits than to the sensitive national security interests of the country. That was one reason. Another reason that the critics focus on is that they didn't want anyone to find out about how their program ran.
In other words, in defending a suit against them, the phone companies in court would reveal the means by which the government got all of this data.
Right, exactly. This was something they hoped to avoid for, you know, the reasons that I mentioned, either to defend the security of the program or, in the eyes of critics, to cover up their own lawbreaking.
Now, in advance of this week's vote, the New York Times and many other newspapers, with a big thumbs up from the ACLU, editorialized against this bill as making the public too vulnerable to government excess. But yet the bill passed by a very large margin in Congress. Why did this big controversy end in such a lopsided vote?
Well, there were a number of factors that went into that. The Senate had always been pretty amenable to the administration's position on all this. The House had really been holding out. What ended up happening was, over time, two things. One, there were some surveillance orders that were approved under a temporary spying law that the president and Congress had agreed to late last summer. And those surveillance orders were going to start expiring beginning in August. The other thing that happened was that there was another group of moderate to conservative Democrats in the House who had been really agitating for something to get done. They had different political pressures than some of the more liberal members in the House because their constituents maybe would be inclined to vote for a Republican who was in favor of this, or so they feared. So as they began to agitate, the House Democratic leadership got worried that if they didn't step in and try to come up with something that was a little bit better than what the administration wanted, that they were going to get what the administration wanted jammed down their throats, whether they liked it or not. Now, another factor that probably played into this was a general concern from Democrats, because typically Republicans go on the attack on national security and say that Democrats are weak on that, and this could have played into that.
Barack Obama voted in the Senate for this new law, having much criticized an earlier version of it. This has raised a lot of eyebrows. Is he trying to get some national security bona fides for the upcoming election?
It certainly looks that way. What's interesting about all that is that the issue of immunity is not particularly popular with people because, frankly, a lot of people don't like their phone companies and aren't really looking to bail them out or help them in any way. And on the issue of how the spying would be conducted, it was extremely complicated, and it was also something that people weren't really sure about one way or the other, about what they wanted.
Okay, Tim. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Tim Starks writes about the intelligence community for Congressional Quarterly.
Jonathan Turley is a law professor at George Washington University who has also served as counsel in a variety of national security cases, including a current one seeking information on the classified surveillance program from the government. He says that the new FISA law puts extra pressure on news outlets because they're the only overseers left.
Before, we did have one of three branches that was functioning. The judicial branch was, in fact, looking into the legality of the program and exploring the possible injuries that had been done to citizens. What Congress effectively did is it shut down that last branch.
But under this bill, are the telecom companies protected from future litigation? Clinton National Security Advisor Nancy Soderbergh says that the new bill lets the companies off the hooks for their past actions, but it won't allow repetitions of that wrong. They could still be charged, right?
Yeah, but it's not much of a distinction because the law also allows the president to engage in warrantless surveillance and makes the process very, very easy. There's no reason for him to repeat exactly what he did before. It's like solving bank robbery by simply taking all the doors off the bank. So we really aren't likely to see telecoms ever prosecuted because the Congress just created a law that is almost impossible to violate.
But it isn't exactly the end of lawsuits. I mean, already just this past Thursday, the ACLU had filed one arguing that the new FISA law is unconstitutional.
Well, perish the thought that we'd ever have the end of lawsuits. But I'm afraid I don't have great expectations for the ACLU lawsuit. I do respect them for filing it. But Congress has shown that it is not willing to let an independent court system evaluate the legality of this program, a program that both Democratic and Republican leaders knew about years ago. So even if you have a successful lawsuit, now lawyers are going to basically tell their clients, look what happened. There were 40 lawsuits that were succeeding in court. We just had a ruling by a court that this entire program was unlawful. And what was Congress's response? They changed the law and terminated all 40 lawsuits.
So explain to me how this new FISA bill matters to journalists.
Ironically, it makes journalists more important than they've ever been. I think if you objectively look at the last few years, you would have to call this the golden age of investigative reporting because we've seen journalists uncover things like the secret camp system, the torture program, the NSA surveillance program. These were enormous disclosures for the public. And when you put all these things up on the board, you're struck by one salient fact, and that is virtually all the progress we've made in the last few years has nothing to do with Congress or the courts. And that should worry us. And it also puts a great deal of pressure on journalists now. And we know a few years ago the Bush administration was pushing for the prosecution of journalists. And I expect we're heading into a confrontation. Because journalists tend to step forward when they sense this vacuum. But more importantly, whistleblowers tend to come forward when they don't see any alternative.
It's funny you should mention this because the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid announced just at the end of this week that the Senate is looking into legislation that would shield reporters from having to reveal their anonymous sources, at least in certain cases, and that he wants to do this before the August recess. Now, this shield law issue has become something of a hardy perennial, like roses. But is there any particular relevance here to the new FISA bill?
It has never been more important. Imagine if reporters didn't do what they've done in the last few years. Imagine if the New York Times didn't reveal the domestic surveillance program. Clearly, Democrats and Republicans knew about it, and so they were not about to reveal it.
Well, Jonathan, imagine if the New York Times didn't reveal it, then Congress wouldn't have had to pass a bill that more or less rubber stamps it.
You know,
though, what you're saying.
I do, but I have to say that there is a value to forcing Congress to take this type of action. It's a good thing when reporters force members of Congress to come out and say, I'm going to extinguish 40 public interest lawsuits. I'm going to cut away part of the Fourth Amendment. I'm going to give retroactive immunity to an industry. It's not a good thing in its result, but it's a good thing that the public can see it. And perhaps the most important thing that reporters do is to allow the public to judge the conduct of its government.
All right. Jonathan, thank you very much.
Oh, it's my great pleasure.
Jonathan Turley is a professor of public interest law at George Washington University.
Coming up, Google sees all, Google knows all. Should you worry?
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. YouTube users are angry with Viacom. And do you know what happens when YouTube users get mad?
Hello, YouTube. Apparently, Viacom, now according to some judge somewhere, has all of our usernames and IP addresses so that they can track if we're watching their copyrighted crap.
Last week, a judge ordered YouTube, a subsidiary of Google, to pass along information about who has watched which YouTube videos, when, and how often. Viacom is looking for evidence to show that YouTube users are downloading clips of Viacom's properties. However, anyone concerned with privacy thinks the ruling goes too far in infringing upon the privacy rights of YouTube users, rights outlined in the Video Privacy Protection Act. Peter Kafka writes for the Silicon Alley Insider, and he joins me now. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Viacom wants the information not to know what I, Bob Garfield, am looking at, but to prove that the preponderance of YouTube downloads are for copyrighted material like its own, The Daily Show, for instance. Do we have any idea what percentage of YouTube videos are copyrighted versus user-generated stuff?
No one except for YouTube really has any idea. YouTube also insists that it doesn't really have any idea because it doesn't actually monitor what it puts up there. Now, a lot of folks think that's actually hard to believe because if you'll go on YouTube, you'll find there's almost no porn on there. And to go to a website where there's almost no porn, you know, people are uploading stuff, someone has to be monitoring that. A great article in the Wall Street Journal this week pointed out that YouTube is only selling ads on 4% of all of its videos. It's worried that there's possible copyright infringement on 96% of all of its videos. So you can get a sense that there's a whole lot of stuff on YouTube that probably violates some kind of copyright protection law. They say that they are protected by the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which basically says if people are uploading stuff to your service but you're not actually filtering it or looking at it yourself, you're not responsible for any copyright violations. Yeah, they sort of repeat this over and over like zombies. And Viacom says, no, you clearly know what's going on there and you're profiting from this, and so this won't work. This is sort of the same debate that we had 10 years ago or so with Napster, and Napster lost that case in the end.
Now, one of the issues in this case is to what degree YouTube is protected by the Video Privacy Protection Act. Tell me how that law fits into this case.
The Video Privacy Protection Act is actually also known as, I think, the Bork Law, if you remember from way back in the 80s during the Bork Supreme Court nominations. Someone dug up, I believe it's Blockbuster video rental history. So in theory, you're not supposed to be able to distribute someone's video watching records. I don't really think this is going to come into play. Both YouTube and Viacom are going out of their way to actually not present any identifiable information.
So in the absence of any identifiable information, why are the privacy hawks so nervous?
Technically, could someone dig up someone's IP address and their username and eventually track down and figure out that someone's been watching a dog on a skateboard video? Yeah, but that's not what Viacom wants to do here. Initially, there was sort of a wave of Viacom's a baddie, because you hear a lot of Viacom's a baddie on the tech blogs. And then folks sort of thought for a day and said, wait a minute, why is actually Google and YouTube keeping records of everyone's viewing habits dating back to the start of this service? And I haven't really heard a good explanation for why that exists. I mean, the most obvious one is it helps them eventually figure out better ways to serve ads on the site.
Now, you have said that there could be a wild card in this case, and that is Sumner Redstone, the chairman of Viacom. How does he figure in?
Well, Sumner Redstone runs the company. It's technically a public company, but it's very much his fiefdom. And Sumner could one day wake up and say, you know what, I choose to settle this case. And he's very erratic. Basically, you don't really know what a billionaire in his 80s who likes to shave himself nude in his bathtub in Beverly Hills is going to do from day to day. So that's a wild card.
Well, yeah, you raise an interesting question. Settling. I suppose some people would like to see this case not settled, but for it to go to court so that a precedent is established and some guidelines finally put on the table. Who's rooting for a judge's decision? Who's rooting for settlement?
I don't think it breaks down along clear lines. I mean, I've talked to folks who are both sort of webby folks, and I've talked to folks who are content folks, and it doesn't split equally. You know, some of them would love to have a bright line drawn here. It says this is what you're allowed to do. It would save them a lot of legal fees, and a lot of them say, look, this is an evolving, breathing thing. You'd hate to have some kind of law that we're going to have to be dealing with 5 years from now when technology and use are completely different than they are now. Let's sort of settle this on a one-to-one basis.
Okay, Peter. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Peter Kafka writes for the Silicon Alley Insider. In the novel 1984, George Orwell wrote, "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past." In our anxious age of information and technology, some have seen the face of Big Brother, and they are calling him Google. According to Nielsen Online, the California-based company, not yet 10 years old, is now responsible for more than three-fifths of all Internet searches in the United States. Of course, Google doesn't just sift through information. It collects and compiles it, too, which, as Boston Globe reporter Drake Bennett wrote recently, has some scholars and programmers pushing back. Drake, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks very much.
So I go on and I do a series of searches during the course of a day or a lifetime, and Google keeps track of all of that stuff. How long does it keep it, and how can it connect it to me as an individual?
Well, it can connect you through cookies, which are these little lines of text that identify the computer that did the search. And Google and other ISPs do now put a time limit on how long they keep cookies and other identifying information. But they do have this record of what the search was and what computer did it for the first year, year and a half. That can be traced back to you. And also, as Google has expanded into email and social networking and things like that, I mean, you're giving them more and more information. And they're holding on to it.
Now, in its privacy policy, Google, cross its heart, hope to die, swears it would never compromise anybody's personal information. And let's assume for a moment that Google would never risk its $10-plus billion-a-year golden goose by selling user data. But the government, especially in the post-9/11 era, does have a frightening history of subpoenaing entire haystacks to locate potential needles. And in 2005, Google itself was subpoenaed. Tell me about that case and how it turned out.
That was a big Justice Department investigation into child pornography. The Justice Department wanted information about what sort of search terms were popular. They wanted to make the case that a lot of people were looking for child pornography. Google, more than any other of the companies that was subpoenaed, really pushed back and fought the case in court and ended up having to release a much smaller amount of information than the government had originally wanted. So Google, if you ask them about privacy issues, will hold this up as an example of how they're going to really go to bat for you. There are other ways besides subpoenas, though, that the federal government goes after information. One of them is national security letters. That's a much lower profile thing and happens probably more often.
And in fact, had Google received any national security letters, we would have no way of knowing that. It could have been forced by the government to surrender information and be legally bound never to disclose that the letter was ever even received.
Yes, exactly. That's a very good point. It's something we would not even hear about.
Now, you mentioned how Google pushed back against the subpoenas in 2005. Others are pushing back against Google. For example, in Finland, an employer is not allowed to do a Google search about a prospective employee. But there's been other solutions for trying to stem the influence of this juggernaut. Can you go through some of them for me, please?
Sure. There are programs one can use or websites one can go through. One of them is something called TrackMeNot. Basically, what TrackMeNot does, it's a Firefox plugin, and every time you do a Google search, it sends out three or four dummy searches based on, you know, what other people are searching at the time. Google has no way of knowing which of those searches was your real search and which was the artificially generated one. And so it sort of creates this white noise and obscures your tracks. Another thing that an increasing number of people are turning to is a site called Scroogle. You go to the Scroogle site and you type in your search query, and Scroogle basically takes the search query and turns around and submits it to Google. So any attempt, any cookies that come back don't make it all the way to you. They stop at the Scroogle site, and Scroogle basically just throws them away. So it sort of serves as this buffer.
We've been talking about privacy issues up till now. You also wrote that there's a new worry arising, and the worry is about what it means when a single company becomes the world's doorway to the entire content of the web. Those are mostly your words. In what ways should we be concerned that Google has such dominance in the search sphere?
Unlike the other organizing systems for information that we've had in the past, like the Dewey Decimal System, for example, Google's algorithm, the thing that decides what information is more and less important, is proprietary. It's a secret. And there's a worry that Google's own agenda, because it is a profit-making entity, could impinge there. For example, there have been a couple cases, lawsuits against Google, where companies have accused Google Inc. of basically blackballing them. The Search King is perhaps the more telling case. It's a company that marketed itself basically as a gamer of the Google algorithm. It sold a service to online companies that wanted to improve their Google ranking. Search King, in its lawsuit, accused Google of basically kicking them out of the Google search results. And Google seems, in its response, to basically admit it that it did so, although there's some debate about that. But more importantly, what Google said was, that's none of your business. I mean, we get to decide how we rank information, and this is basically free speech.
It makes some people think of the railroads, which were owned by private companies, but which nonetheless, because they were essential monopolies and because they so influenced the public economy, the federal government regulated them.
It sort of gets at this larger question of, you know, what is a search engine? What, you know, do we treat them like newspapers? Do we treat them like television stations? Or do we treat them like public utilities where they're providing this service that people increasingly cannot live without, and that as a result, the government needs to decide the terms of access?
Drake, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Drake Bennett is a reporter for the Ideas section of the Boston Globe.
July was supposed to mark the start of an intriguing obscenity trial, one that would demonstrate once again the revelatory power of Google. Alas, it was not to be. The prosecution settled. It all began in June 2006 in a little town outside Pensacola, Florida, where Clinton McCowan owned, operated, and filmed vignettes for his extremely adult website, the initials of which are COHF. If you need to know what that stands for, look it up on Google. We know people do lots of naughty searches in, for instance, Pensacola, and it is on that knowledge that McCowan's case turned. All obscenity trials turn on a few key issues set in a 1973 Supreme Court case called Miller v. California, the first of which is, and I'm quoting here, whether the average person applying contemporary community standards would find that the work, taken as a whole, appeals to the prurient interest. Since so much of this stuff is designed with prurient interests in mind, the operative phrase seems to be community standards and whether the material exceeds them. But how do you determine that? McCowan's lawyer, Lawrence Walters, used a new widget called Google Trends to see what Pensacolans searched for online and found that such terms as orgy and group sex were searched far more than apple pie or ethanol or boating. Slate's Will Saladin recently wrote that when it comes to community standards, the prosecution had a clear definition of standards, but the community part, not so much.
The defense's argument is, you know, you can't prosecute this pornographer by the supposed standards of the local community because, in fact, if you look at Google, you can see how the local people actually behave. They were searching for orgy and other naughty terms. So those are their real standards. They shouldn't be held to their hypocritical standards that they claim in public. The prosecution's position on this is basically a defense of hypocrisy. Wait a minute. Yeah, these people were, you know, looking for naughty words online, but that's not their standards. That's their behavior. And their standards are they expect better of themselves and others. And you know what? I think the prosecution is right about that. You can't judge standards by behavior because we all aspire to be better than we are.
So you agree with the prosecution, but the action that they take is where you part company because you say, since Google shows us that human beings are dual creatures or maybe multiple creatures, they shouldn't have to follow a single rule, the rule based in the non-virtual world.
That's right. And the linchpin for making that argument legally is the other half of the phrase community standards. Community. What is the community? Now, the prosecution is treating this case as though the community is Pensacola and the surrounding area where this pornographer was officially headquartered. And if you're talking about the offline world, what we think of as the real world where people walk around, that's technically true. But the smut is being purveyed online. And that online community is completely different. You are getting an audience that is both much broader geographically and much narrower in terms of its tastes and, in this case, fetishes. So you can't really judge this smut that is being peddled to that community by the standards of the geographic community in which the pornographer is technically located.
You know, it's just fascinating. We have done a lot on this program about Second Life and role playing online, but you're saying that really anybody who does a search that they wouldn't admit to in their ordinary life is, in a sense, playing a role, inhabiting a different person.
Yeah, and it's not even clear which one of those is the real person. And I don't even think we need to settle that question. And now we have, with the age of the internet, this gray area where you're sort of acting privately. Your spouse doesn't know you're online searching for the word orgy, but you're also sort of in public in the sense that you are communing with other people in this anonymous online world. And now, thanks to Google, we can track you. We may not know who you are exactly, but we know that you people in Pensacola, you're searching for the word orgy.
You know, for years, some members of Congress have tried to craft a Communications Decency Act to ride herd on some of the chaos that goes on online. It keeps getting defeated on First Amendment grounds, but you're offering a whole new argument against it.
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to Congress. They really are trying to figure out how to legislate in the world of new media. I think they see the internet as this frightening new means, for example, for predators to track down children. And, you know, that is a legitimate worry. For some people, it is a means of getting to a physical crime. Once there's a physical crime, you can prosecute it that way. But for other people, it's just not. It's like blowing off steam, or it's where they can live in a fantasy world. It's like they're living in their own head. So I think Congress has had trouble just reining itself in and treating this world in a way that can be perhaps monitored, can be surveilled, but not prosecuted the way that you would prosecute a tangible crime. You know, do we want to prosecute virtual crime? Are you then on your way to prosecuting what Orwell called thought crime? This is a very difficult world that we need to figure out legally and morally.
You also have some more advice to legislators, which amounts to don't confuse pictures with the real thing and essentially accept our dual nature, accept hypocrisy.
This case that we're talking about is just one of a number of cases where we're getting into things that aren't quite real, and they're all of a sexual nature. We have this case. We have the recent case of a federal judge who had a file share, and as somebody hacks into his family's computer and finds some dirty pictures. But, you know, he's treated as though he's done something when, in fact, it's just something that's sitting on a computer. And then we have a worldwide trend, basically, of legislating against fake child pornography, purely digitally produced stuff. It's just not real, and it's being legislated against and prosecuted as though it's the real thing. We need to step back. We really need to step back from this and ask ourselves whether we want to treat virtual reality as though it's the real thing.
Will, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Will Saladin is national correspondent for Slate.
Coming up, we're beginning to think they're up to no good over at Fox News.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And the Wallace Foundation, whose knowledge center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, The Washington Post announced the appointment of an executive editor to succeed the retiring Leonard Downey. Marcus Brockley, forced out recently from the managing editorship of The Wall Street Journal by new owner Rupert Murdoch, will be only the third executive editor at the Post since Ben Bradley rose to the position in 1968. He will not, however, be the only new top editor in town. Over at the Washington Times, the conservative daily owned by a subsidiary of Reverend Sun Myung Moon's Unification Church, former Post and AP reporter John Solomon took over the executive editorship in January and has already made his presence felt. Last month, for instance, the Times broke a page one investigation revealing how Iraq veterans are being used as guinea pigs in drug experiments. Among Solomon's first acts as boss, one ridiculed in the right-wing blogosphere, was to abolish the Times' use of such politically inflected descriptors as homosexual and illegal alien, when journalistic convention has long since settled on gay and illegal immigrant.
The rationale that I had and my colleagues had was that some of these terms, homosexual marriage with quotes around marriage and illegal aliens, were at times distracting our readers. For instance, illegal alien, both illegal and alien mean you don't belong. I thought, and I believe the newsroom thought, that the term illegal immigrant actually conveyed more information. Illegal is still stating that they didn't belong here, but immigrant getting at their intention, their motive, which is that they were trying to enjoy the benefits of immigration, but without going through the legal process. And so we removed a redundancy, and I think we added some value.
Nonetheless, to the world of ideologues, that was kind of a shot across the bow. Was there any grumbling within your organization?
None whatsoever. In fact, it was widely supported top to bottom. And, you know, it's always been a conservative center-right newspaper on its editorial pages. That's a great position for it. It's been a valuable voice in that respect. When I came in, I made a conscious decision that I would run the news section of the newspaper, create a bright line to make sure that the newspaper did fair and balanced and accurate and precise news every day, and leave the job of opinionating and influence making in Washington to an expert in that field.
The Washington Times has always been dwarfed by the Washington Post by a factor of 6 or 7, something like that. But it has also been the conservative counterpoint. It seems to me that under John Solomon, the newspaper has become sort of like a mini Wall Street Journal, hard right on the editorial side, but within the news pages, right down the middle, which raises the question, does the world need a second Wall Street Journal?
Wall Street covers Wall Street. We cover Washington, and we have a unique perch in the nation's capital, the power center of the world. And so is there room for a Wall Street Journal-like newspaper in Washington? The answer is overwhelmingly yes. And there's validation of this. Are we losing position? Absolutely not. Advertising's up since I got here. More importantly, web traffic has more than doubled. In fact, it's closing in on tripling in less than 4 months. What does that tell you? People want relevant, compelling news, regardless of what's on the editorial pages.
The consensus seems to be that the newspaper has been the linchpin of the Reverend Sun Myung-moon's decades-long effort to curry favor with conservative political figures, from Dwight Eisenhower to George Bush. And that, in short, the Times is a loss leader for the church's worldwide fundraising campaign. In that environment, was it difficult for you to sign on for this job?
I don't think the religious affiliation of some of the owners or the executives in this company has any more bearing on what I do as a journalist every day than the religious affiliation of Don Graham had when I was at the Washington Post, or Lou Bacardi when I was at the Associated Press. At the end of the day, if you are free to editorially pursue the values of journalism, you're going to do as good a news job at the Washington Times as you would at the Post or the New York Times.
However, in the past, that separation between church and state, as it's called, has not always been sacrosanct. The founding editor of the paper resigned, complaining about editorial interference. Mind you, that was 20 years ago, but resigned nonetheless. And in the intervening time, there have been, you know, there's been a lot of really positive publicity about the Reverend Moon's appearances around the world and so forth that probably would not have made the cut if the newspaper did not have church affiliation. So how sure are you that they're going to keep their nose out of your business?
I can tell you, I talked to Wes Pruden, my predecessor here. He couldn't think of an instant in his entire 15, 16-year tenure where anyone in ownership or even leadership above him tried to exert any influence over the editorial report. He had an independence clause in his contract, making sure that he had editorial independence. I can assure you, I feel both contractually, morally, and ethically that I have editorial independence. And I've seen things at other news organizations where I've either worked or been working with as a representative from the AP, where there were instances where ownership would cool something down or do something. Here, I don't see any interference, and if there ever was, I'm sure you would hear about it from me first.
All right, John. Thank you so much.
Thanks again.
John Solomon is executive editor of the Washington Times. John Gorenfeld is the author of the recent book, Bad Moon Rising, How Reverend Moon Created the Washington Times, Seduced the Religious Right, and Built an American Kingdom. He says that Solomon misses the point. It's not about unification church interference in the newspaper's editorial decisions. Rather, he says, it's the use of the Washington Times itself as a Trojan horse for the church's dubious fundraising and other activities around the world. Activities, he says, which cannot be cleansed by the most earnest editor, much less changes in the style book.
I think John Solomon, who isn't a movement conservative, has come in very idealistically. He's made some moves towards the mainstream, like no longer allowing gay marriage to be in scare quotes. But look, this is great news for the Reverend Moon Church, which was really suffering some PR problems in the last few years.
Now, from day one, the Times has claimed to be independent of the church and of Moon himself. But you say that's baloney. Why is it baloney?
What I discovered in talking to editors of the Washington Times over the years, including some who had quit, saying that they had blood on their hands for empowering a man that they considered a cult leader, what I discovered was that among some people it was really considered a joke that there was this separation, considering that whether it was demanding that the editorial page favor the Unification Church's stance on South Korean policy, or more recently, even running full-fledged plugs for Reverend Moon initiatives at the United Nations, it's really not much of a wall, but more of a floor. And in fact, on the third floor of the Washington Times building are church offices. And I think if the New York Times had the Church of Scientology on the top floor, and if Tom Cruise was showing up, as Moon has, raving about how his newspaper has contributed to the church's agenda, I think they would get a lot of flack for that.
Let's right now get to that idea of how the paper does fit into Moon's modus and his motives. The book begins with an absolutely astonishing moment on Capitol Hill in 2004. Can you tell me about the coronation?
Yeah, well, the Washington Times Foundation arranged for Reverend Moon to be honored on Capitol Hill as the Messiah, as the Second Coming and the King of America. And a number of congressmen were present while he donned a magnificent crown and robes, and there were congressmen bowing to him, literally, and bringing his holy costume.
Now, a lot of prominent politicos who do show up at Moon events and offer endorsements of various kinds seem to have been caught unawares. But others who are associated with Moon's operations are actually on the payroll. They get large speaking fees and so forth, like President George H.W. Bush.
George H.W. Bush has long maintained a relationship with Reverend Moon, taking over $1 million to tour Japan and Argentina with Sun Myung Moon or his wife, showing up in 1995, most notably, to help bail out the Unification Church from a lot of trouble it was in for separating desperate widows from their life savings, saying that their husbands were in hell and wouldn't escape unless they gave millions of yen to the Unification Church. In Buenos Aires, George H.W. Bush called Reverend Moon the man with the vision whose newspaper restores sanity to Washington, D.C.
Now, here's a guy who says he's talked to Stalin in hell, person to person, and has been convicted of tax fraud. In fact, was in prison like 5 minutes after the Washington Times first appeared. He conducts mass arranged marriages in stadiums. He's accused of brainwashing children and using them as almost slave labor. He's got followers who were appointees in the Bush administration. He was, as you said, crowned as the savior in the Dirksen office building. Why aren't people just showing him the door? How does he continue to operate? Maybe he is God.
Well, he's richer than God. Conservatives have been enormously grateful for what they see as the balance that's been provided by Reverend Moon's newspaper. And so they've been willing to work with this guy, even as more and more shocking things have happened over the years. What we're looking at is one of the most dazzling acts of either con artistry or public relations in modern day history. The enormous outlay for the Washington Times has made the Unification Church part of conservative history, whereas otherwise they might well have been booted from the country in the 1980s. The issue isn't so much the idea of getting tentacles within the administration or having some sort of actual power. What it is this cynical relationship with conservatives that's allowed Reverend Moon in places beyond our borders to continue bilking all sorts of people out of money and ruining a lot of people's lives while finding a surprisingly comfortable home for himself right here in Washington, D.C.
Okay, John. Well, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Reporter John Gorenfeld is author of Bad Moon Rising, How Reverend Moon Created the Washington Times, Seduced the Religious Right, and Built an American Kingdom.
Fox News has always inveighed against what it calls the liberal media. It's such an old story that, frankly, we stopped covering it. So we probably wouldn't have noticed when Fox and Friends hosts Steve Doocy and Brian Kilmeade slammed New York Times editor Stephen Redicliffe and reporter Jacques Steinberg for a story about how CNN was catching up to Fox News in this election cycle.
So anyway, Radar says he's had an axe to grind, and that's why he sends his attack dog, Jacques Steinberg, out, that fellow right there, the writer for the New York Times, to do these hit pieces. So he essentially is his attack dog, his poodle, if you will.
We wouldn't have noticed it except for the fact that they illustrated the invective with doctored photos of the Timesmen with hairlines pushed back, teeth yellow, dark circles under their eyes, and in Steinberg's case, his nose and ears enlarged in ways reminiscent of something that might have appeared in Der Stürmer in, say, 1940. Was it a joke or revenge? Media reporters say that just mentioning CNN and Fox News in the same story is considered a cardinal sin by Fox Public Relations. The New York Times' David Carr wrote about Fox's PR operation in his column this week. He says it has a scary reputation. He also says it's unseemly for a news outlet to act that way.
I'm in the news business, and when somebody calls me and needs to speak to a reporter at the New York Times, I pick up the phone. Every once in a while, do I check with Catherine Mathis, our corporate spokesperson, about whether I'd be seen as speaking for the institution? Should I speak up? Sure, I do. But we're people who send out reporters on Christmas Day after, you know, maybe their child has tragically gone through the ice, and we expect them to come to the door and talk about what happened to their child. And for a media organization to erect a gigantic apparatus around it, which seems to be in the business of not answering questions, I think, is the height of hypocrisy.
As you say, this PR mechanism at Fox News is extraordinarily vigilant and aggressive, but you took this occasion to write about it. Was there something about these photos that just was beyond the pale?
Part of the reason I stepped up to it was a couple of months ago, a friend of mine was doing a story about, he works at the paper here, about cable news ratings, and he was suggesting that the election had helped CNN creep up on Fox. And when he called Fox for a comment, he was threatened on deadline. And he wrote this story, and sure enough, in the blogs the next day, there was all manner of personal, private, medical information splashed around every which way. And I thought it was appalling. I thought, well, this is really hardcore. I've covered politics. I've covered cops. This is really playing it bloody. And at the time, I called reporters at other news organizations not directly involved. And I said, you know what? This is a huge story that as somebody who's in the business of public relations would be so aggressive in managing information as to smear somebody that was writing about him. I think it's an extraordinary story. And they all said, yeah, that's a great story. I'm not going near it. I don't want these people on my tail.
You began your piece with this sentence. Like most working journalists, whenever I type seven letters, F-O-X-N-E-W-S, a series of alarms begins to whoop in my head. Danger, warning, much mayhem ahead.
That is describing precisely and exactly what happens to me whenever I type those letters. And there's other people I could mention where when I type those letters, like if I'm going to write about Harvey Weinstein, I always know when I type those letters that many things are going to happen afterwards. Some of them will not be pleasant for me. And I think what sets Fox News apart is their relentlessness. And they have no sense of scale. They're as interested in what was in the third to last paragraph as they are in the lead. It's very short-sighted in that I think that if you grow relationships over time, that you would see different stories. You'd see wonderful, great stories about Shepard Smith's heroic reporting in New Orleans. We'd see that elusive story about Bill O'Reilly's soft side. I've never seen it, but I'm sure it exists.
You're saying they're missing out on some good publicity by being so intrusive when it comes to all publicity?
I do think that there's been times when it would have been good for me as either a working reporter, beat reporter on media issues, or as a columnist to mention Fox News in passing, and I just really haven't wanted to go there. And that's not nice to say, that's not good to admit, but if you wobble off course or off message for one little sentence, all of a sudden you'll have flying monkeys all over you. And who wants that after all? I mean, the weird thing is I called these guys, and I most definitely had an agenda when I called them. And I said, this is what I'm going to say, that you guys are a huge pain in the butt to work with, and you drive working reporters crazy, and that your aggression is counterproductive. And they worked with me courteously and carefully all through the weekend and then sent me a nice follow-up note. So it's the sort of asymmetries that keep you keep you guessing. It's like, for them to be depicted as an extremely aggressive outfit that's willing to go to enormous lengths to protect the interests of the organization, the talent, and the people who run it, I don't think is something that bothers them.
It isn't the sort of thing that created, you know, outside the bandwidth responses like doctored photos or personal information leaked onto blogs. Only stories about CNN catching up to Fox seem to do that.
Brooke, how long have you been reporting on the media for?
13 years.
Are they just not the biggest babies there ever were? Are they just not the worst? You know, pity us poor fools who stand the media full time. They're a pack of whiners, I gotta say.
David, all I can say is word.
Word!
David Carr is a media reporter and columnist for the New York Times. We asked Fox News to respond. They declined and referred us back to their statements in David Carr's column in the New York Times.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and Nadia Zonis, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Gina Gasper. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.